Blog Talk Radio.
Of the craft. Here, we're like to think that masonry rubs shoulders with the perhaps even the that state of reason that compares well to the altered state of consciousness. It sets the thinking not apart. But it is for the reason through, it's incumbent upon you to imperative share this insight and find somebody receptive and within this fine day in 2019. It's remarkable where I am. I realize that I live in a gifted situation compared to a lot of and people who are for various reasons suffering misfortunes, and I'd like to think that we are able to find those moments of solace together. Oh, that lodge meetings would be able to help us focus the mind. We can all appreciate the clamor, we can, but there are those masons, reflective, contemplative. You can see them wherever you go. They're friendly enough, topical enough, but quick to dwell on ideas within the ritual, within the protocols. And that's the amazing part. Does Freemasonry still have that appeal? Well, around the world, we're being asked that question, aren't we? Maybe we're reaping the reward of the secular environment or the transparency caused by social media. the dirty little secrets are coming to the surface. In a way, we're being cleansed, but it means that we have to be able to, I think, move on. That was then, this is now. And think about what it tells us about humanity. Humanity is flawed or imperfect. We tend to have conscience, and we tend to want to hide our misdeeds because of that sense of conscience. Or we're unable to extend ourselves compassionately to the well-being of others. For you, my brethren, we want to reflect in your own way. Come to your own conclusions. Hopefully, we are moving along that path to sense of revelation, some sense of purpose, some sense of the meanings that will become apparent as we draw our last breaths. The meaning of what's going on around us, there's a joy. There's a satisfaction in accepting what you have, no matter your lot. Don't let anybody fool you that only the oligarchs and the ultra wealthy have complete satisfaction. That, as we know, is a fallacy. Chasing that doesn't give purpose to a life. But it certainly can keep you busy. We're going to move through the show today, move through the program, Motivation in an Era of Stardom. You can see the themes of the poetry today. Well, I'm picking up on some notions. I want to just read you a little piece to give you an idea where I'm coming from today. Share that with you. Then we'll get into some decent music. Oh, I promise you that. Really, really good music. This is by one of my favorite authors, Tobias Churton. Some of you may be familiar with his work. And this is from the Canterbury Papers, Volume 4. Brilliant idea. An innocent trip from Helgen's Kreutz in the Tyrol to Innsbruck in the autumn of 1612. Brought a shock to Adam Halsmeyer, a musician, theosopher, medical celebrity, and notary public to the Archduke Maximilian. On the orders of the Jesuit inquisitor, Hyplit Granoli, Halsmeyer was arrested and sentenced to slavery on the Mediterranean galleys. And why? Now let this be a message to you. All of us. In March, Halsmeyer had published his answer to the Fatma Fraternitatis, the fame of the fraternity, a manuscript which had been privately distributed to persons with an interest in the advancement of science and religion in a corrupt society. Truth to power always comes at a risk.
Thank you.
maybe before you step into your next lodge meeting, you put on the headphones and you listen to an episode of Masonic Effect. You can argue and debate as you usually do, and disagree all over the place. But do it as an experiment. I think it changes our mindset, soothes it in some way, and then walk into the lodge. Nobody will be any the wiser. See what effect it has on you, on the outcome of your, the depth of reasoning that happens in the lodge. You may be surprised. Here, we're going to have an, I think a really interesting, this is an interesting commentary today. Not awesome. I don't know what awesome and superstar and things like that mean anymore. I don't. I know what good means and awkward, and I know when I feel impatient. I don't know awesome. I know joy. Motivation in an era of stardom. I came to this topic because we're going through reviews and a great deal of effort by very, very talented men to guide and to develop options for the future of our craft. It doesn't just happen by itself, as you know. The appeal, well, it's different. It's complex, isn't it? What draws a good man toward masonry? And it occurred to me that often in the literature, often in presentations, I'm hearing what to do. The idea is basically what to do, what to, the uniqueness of a perspective. But rarely, if ever, except in some of my own work, there's no apparent notion of motivation. Yes, I guess I drank that Kool-Aid with a psychologist and a psychiatrist a long time ago. What motivates a man to join Freemasonry? Is that so awkward to want to understand that? If we're going to try and make ourselves known in a reasonable and thoughtful way to other men like us, is it so unreasonable to think that there may be a connection in terms of the motivation, other than wanting to be part of a club or a service? Freemasonry is not a club, and it's neither that or a service, nor is it a business. Nor is it a business. Because it's defining. We become something. Something else, redefined by our obligations, or the nature of our obligations, is sensitivity and appreciation of very ancient ideas, things that we hold dear. Not everybody articulates them the same, but we all understand, understand that. Gravity. And sit back and tell me what you think of this. What and why? If I were asked to identify the ethos of Freemasonry in Upper Canada, I'll put that in brackets, these ideas come immediately to mind. What and why? An ancient fraternal order appeals to men for whom the larger questions of life are personal and private. Why Masonry deserves a reasoned response. 15th century was a time when science was truth to power, unraveling the estates and taking human agency to a new level. Why has elements of the Enlightenment, the Reformation, and Counter-Reformation, as well as nation, seen clearly on the Scottish landscape. A civil war, plague, and a fire that razed London gave reason to question beliefs. And time did not stand still when London bureaucrats successfully sold the idea of linkage, Grand Lodge, and what we know as Grand Lodge. Time didn't stop. Embracing humanist philosophy, the freedom to think and reason, undermined demagoguery and demagogues. We did not wait long for the system that tolerated poverty, the greatest element of social exploitation, was attacked by gentrified women in Britain and embraced by the nascent order. What and why are elements that exist within the craft always in balance? If you will allow the protons of our molecular structure, the generation of masonry around the world required translation and adaptation to the locale. Authority and uniformity were replaced with constitutional accountability, the work of each Grand Lodge. Today, we clamor to address the paradox, seeming decline in membership as migration takes on epic proportion worldwide and our citizenry increases. To understand, we need look no further than the type of men who reluctantly received the William Mercer Wilson Award, a group of self-effacing men who remained active in service of the lodge, the foot soldiers. They are unusual because, unlike the rest of us, they do not seek recognition. Rank does not eclipse being a Mason. So what inspires and appeals to them? Has anyone asked? Always the quiet guy, going about his business without fanfare. Better to ask the aggressive, loud crowd, huh? Better to address the clamor in the agora. How day be day? Touch. Thank you. don't know about you, but nothing primes me for a review of Alfred Lord Tennyson's work than listening to a little Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli. Interesting. We're going to read a bit today about Alfred Lord Tennyson. Interesting guy. T.S. Eliot. We've covered some of Eliot's work, and I think it's very interesting. Interesting minds. T.S. Eliot said, Alfred Lord Tennyson had the finest ear of any English poet since Milton. Now, I'm not going to claim to be a student of Milton or Tennyson or even Eliot. I have, at best, a passing fascination and appreciation for their work. And it takes me time to process, maybe that's my process, to understand the connections, writers and ideas and history. And this work is, I find, stimulating. And I've accepted that notion that poetry reveals truths about the world. It puts definition to our existence in ways that history cannot. It's like when you look at a painting, you look at Van Gogh, and all of a sudden you connect, you get what the painter, what the artist was trying to convey, its ideas, whether it's a sculpture or painting or poetry or music or dance. They are ideas. And once you get a sense of what those ideas are, one of the greatest conversations I think you could ever possibly imagine is with a professor of drama. If you know one, take him or her out to dinner and just be prepared to be enthralled. Finest ear since Milton, while lines from his Crimean War poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, are indelibly lodged in the minds of even the most poetically resistant. Yeah, that guy. He was born in 1809. As the Napoleonic Wars raged in Europe, he was the fourth of 12 children and a student at Cambridge, where he was awarded the Chancellor's Gold Medal. And he published his first solo collection at 21. His second collection in 1833 met with a lot of criticism, and he did not publish for 10 years. But his third was successful and included Ulysses, a rally call for one of last heroic action. Here goes something like this. And as you listen, Ulysses declares that there is little point in his staying home by this still hearth with his old wife, doling out rewards and punishments for the unnamed masses who live in his kingdom. Why is this important? Is that state of mind irrelevant to today? If it is right now, it will be. If it's irrelevant for you today, it will be tomorrow or the next day. That I can promise. Reflection. It little profits that an idle king, by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know me not. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that love me and alone on shore and wind. Through scudded drifts, the rainy Hades vex the dim sea. I am become a name, for always roaming with a hungry heart. Much have I seen and known, cities of men and manners, climates, councils, governments. Myself not least, but honored of all of them, and drunk delight of battles with my peers. Far from the ringing plains of windy Troy, I am a part of all that I have met. Yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades. Forever and forever when I move, how dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use. As though to breathe were life, life piled on life, were all too little, and of one to me little remains. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more, a bringer of new things, and vile it were for some three suns to store and hoard myself. And this gray spirit yearning and desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. This is my son, mine own Telemachus, to whom I leave this specter and the isle, well loved of me, discerning to fulfill this labor by slow prudence to make mild. A rugged people, and through soft degrees subdue them to the useful and the good. Most blameless is he, centered in the sphere of common duties, decent not to fail in offices of tenderness and pay meet adoration to my household gods. And when I'm gone, he works his work, I mine. There lies the port. The vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark broad seas, my mariners, souls that have toiled and wrought and thought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine and opposed free hearts, free foreheads. You and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all, but something near the end, some work of noble note, may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes and the slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, come, my friends. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off. And seeking well in order, smite the sounding furrows, for my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars till I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be that we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles, whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Desmond and Jerry Mulligan. Yeah, that works. Well, I think it's, if I look at the clock on the wall, it's time for a glass of port. Seems appropriate for this next portion of the program. There are those of you, those of us, for whom the idea of change, the struggle with change, seems odd. Change is around us all the time. Perhaps it is a state of mind more than anything else. a state of awareness. But Masonry has made a great deal about this notion of this struggle, not the notion of change, but the struggle. Maybe it's a way of making us and keeping us aware and not to be rash in what we do, to move forward, to adapt, translate, if you will, without necessarily giving up the primary elements of Freemasonry, those ancient landmarks. We have to, in order to do this, we have to be aware of the ancient landmarks. And we have to be aware of the importance of our history. Wherever we are around the world, not everybody relates to Britain and British history, but we can find threads, stepstones that guide us through history and reflect the Masonic values. And we find that they are enduring and adaptable. Yeah. We're going to unpack a piece of work about Masonic clothing, getting to the end of Colin Dyer's work on symbolism. And I just wanted to take this sideways just for a moment to talk to you about the way Freemasonry has dealt with this notion of deeper meanings. I'll just share this with you. This is from a work by J. Scott Kenny. I do hope, if you are a student, that you will take a moment to pick up this, find this article, and give it a read. It is compelling, and it's fairly current. Yes, Ritual Actions and Meaning Among Freemasons: A Sociological Approach by J. Scott Kenny, Kenney. And in this introduction, secret societies are becoming an increasingly controversial topic in Western society. They have been thrust into public awareness through popular books such as The Da Vinci Code, all hail the Da Vinci Code, of course, and such films as National Treasure. In academia, this interest has been paralleled by a recent proliferation of research and the opening of institutions such as the Masonic Research Center at the University of Sheffield. Yet the former tend to be caricatures, a playing to perverse, pervasive stereotypes for public consumption. The latter, on the other hand, tend to focus on historical and philosophical matters. And he refers us to Petrie Stone's 2005, Wade 2002. Indeed, in the limited extent that a sociological focus exists in the academic research, it largely emphasizes the roles played by such groups in social history. There has, however, been a paucity of work on the contemporary meaning of active participation in these groups for the members themselves. I'll just read that again. There has, however, been a paucity of work on the contemporary meaning of active participation in these groups for the members themselves. I intend to begin addressing this theoretical and empirical neglect with reference to the symbolic interactionist literature in sociology and drawing upon qualitative data from contemporary Freemasons. I tentatively elaborate the theoretical base for the ritualistic enactment of meaning and identity among contemporary members of the craft. Moreover, given the futility of ever coming to a definitive meaning of Masonic symbolism, despite much effort having been spent on this in the past, I tend to draw out a series of key theoretical concepts which may be useful in examining the specific social psychological methods that Freemasons today employ to enact, make sense of, and continually reconstruct symbolic meanings inherent and ritual practices, ultimately integrating them into their personal identities and social lives. Ultimately integrating them. Doesn't that do it? American philosopher G.H. Meade wrote this in 1934 when he sought to address the problem of the meaning of meaning. I remember that during my, you know, my dilettante days as a student. We all were boys at one time. We were teens full of opinions, not a little thin on fact, but full of opinions. And some never get quite step out of that mold, you know, full of opinions, but fact. This is influenced by the thought of C.S. Pierce and William James and his colleague John Dewey. Meade argued that meaning is pragmatically created to the interplay of social activity and significant symbols, sometimes reinforcing, other times creatively innovating new understandings. In this process, meaning is not fixed, but emergent from symbols, actions, and what given individuals bring to a given situation. And significantly, Meade argued that many encounters can go on unreflectively, but should there be a disruption of one's previous activity, a search for and construction of meaning goes hand in hand with endeavors toward a practical solution. I know. That's a lot to absorb, particularly when we're not used to that type of range of conversation. Just give it a thought. And we're going to unpack some of the final work by Colin Dyer. Here, see if Meade's concepts can hold something for you, that there's an emergence. It's not a static event, but this emergent collision of these elements in the moment. And what meaning does it have for you today? You who grow up with a predatory capitalism and where the others are able to live on the shoulders following the battle and make a living. The clothing and lodge worn by Masons under the English Constitution follows a basic design settled by the Board of Works and approved by the United Grand Lodge of England early in 1814. The need for uniformity in use had been created by the union of the two former Grand Lodges in December 1813. And the decision covered the size, shape, decoration, and colors of aprons, collars, and jewels of office. There has, of course, been some development since that date, but without much substantial change, and there has been need on occasion to provide additional clothing or jewels, particularly when additional offices have been created. This was not the start of distinctive Masonic clothing for wearing in lodge. The principle goes back into the mists of antiquity, both in connection with providing a distinctive badge for Masons and for providing recognizable differences for rank or office. For, as the lecture tells us, distinctions among men are necessary to preserve subordination. In other words, there has got to be a management. Such is the nature of our Constitution that, as some must of necessity rule and teach, so others must, of course, learn, submit, and obey. The necessity for some form of due subordination must have had some influence, for these were times when political and social unrest were beginning to make themselves felt in England. These times were, before true democracy in public affairs, still in the same reign which had witnessed the revolt of the American colonies on the score, of no taxation without representation. Among the early drafts for part of the obligation in the second degree put forth in 1814 and actually taken into use in some places, although it was afterwards abandoned, there occur the following words: "As a craftsman, I will continue to pay due obedience to a master mason, whilst from an entered apprentice, I will preserve." In the society of those days, the important thing was for a man to know his place and to know how to keep his place. It was in these conditions that much of our procedure and usage of today was first formulated. Hence, there is distinction of Masonic rank on the badge. John Ladd published four lectures in 1770 under the title of The Science of Free Masonry Explained. He acknowledged that he had compiled these lectures from the works of earlier writers, so that the following passages may represent the speculative thinking of the middle 18th century. "It is not a white, red, or yellow apron or gaudy ribbon with an impending trifling jewel or anything specifically striking that entitles a brother to be called a good mason. Nor is he who can answer by rotation and ready fluency the catechetical question commonly called the working of a lodge that merits the title of a perfect mason. But at the same time, whatever appears meritoriously respectable for the honor and emulation of the craft is highly commendable and ought properly to be aspired after." The basic badge of the speculative mason was an obvious choice in a moral society arising from one which used such clothing in its normal operation. Our forebears, religious men, sought justification in Holy Writ and found it in Genesis chapter 3. This and the mention in Numbers were not the only mentions of an apron, for there are many references to the wearing of an ephod, particularly by Hebrew priests. As many writers have informed us, the ephod of the priests was an apron type garment of linen. The apron is an unusual badge for a society, but has ever been worn in the craft with pride and has occasioned as much speculative thought and writing as any of the Masonic symbols. Prior to 1814, there was no standard design in England, the apron usually consisting of a complete lambskin worn in a convenient manner. And in the years just prior to the Union of 1813, often decorated at the whim of the wearer with Masonic symbols and hieroglyphics. The only distinction officially laid down was the incorporation of a color, usually by lining, dark blue being used for grand officers and red for grand stewards. The lambskin has always been white and from 1814 remained plain white for the apprentice, although now with a definite shape. Some lodges make a practice of having the apprentice wear his apron with the flap down, the fellow craft having the flap turned down. As the English Constitution, this distinction is unnecessary and was not intended. Two rosettes decorate the fellow craft's apron and provide all the distinction that is required. In some constitutions, there is no difference in design between the apron of the apprentice and that of the fellow craft, and this method of wearing the flap is the only distinguishing mark. Entered apprentice, flap up. Fellow craft, flap down. Enough. That's more than a banquet for the mind for a little while. Something to think about. The next time you're walking through the halls of your lodge and you're aware and experiencing that mind palace where symbols have been collected and observed perhaps you'll reflect on Mead's work, The Meaning of Meaning, that there's a constant remixing of the chemistry of Freemasonry, of symbols, and its bearing. A large part of it, the bearing, has to do with you, what you're doing day by day, how they affect you. That's it for now. Hope you've enjoyed sharing some ideas. We're in need here in Upper Canada of the tools of the builders again, not to replace what we have, but to build on, to continue the build. Cathedral is partly built. Now we're in a generation where we're going to examine it in a way that wasn't feasible back in the day, where we had to trust ideas and make determinations for ourselves, not to be persuaded through rhetoric, but through reason, whether the support of these ideas held merit. You think back in the day, 1717, we didn't have these ideas articulated as we do today, character development and hindsight. The caprice of history, 1813, has led us to have a way of an approach to ritual, to symbolism. It's not all, that's not the history, symbolism, and philosophy of Freemasonry, is not the total sum. You add your character, your imagination to that knowledge. You're processing that information in a unique way, different than me, perhaps similar, but different. I hope it settles well within you that this isn't a change, but it's ongoing adaptation. I don't know that the trees around me in nature, the plants around me, and the people and animals around me, all life around me is static. I don't know that. I know that everything is in motion. I know that the geometry that I was taught when I was a boy has been redeveloped. Euclidean geometry, yeah, but fractal geometry, who knew, except deep thinkers, that there was a mathematics to nature, to the waves, to the clouds, to the leaves. I'll leave you with that and wish you best wishes in completing those random Masonic favors, acts of kindness, for no other reason than it feels right to you. And approach life with a smile. Do your fellow man a favor. Here's a little Wynton Kelly trio. I'll see you soon. Although I may take next week off, so I'll look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. We'll take a little break to be with family. And try and generate some stimulating ideas for your life. Goodbye, my brethren. Look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.